Welcome back to Canuck is a Slur, a podcast about cool, cursed, and curious Canadian history and culture. Once again, I am Kelly, and joining me again is Tanner from Beyond the Breakers. How are you doing, Tanner?
I'm doing very well. Very well still.
How did you enjoy the pee break? Did you pee?
I did pee. I did also pull up. I was curious about where Johnson's Island was off of Ohio.
Okay.
And it is pretty close to like Kelly's Island and the stuff, like the Bass Islands over there. So lucky you, you do have an island waiting for you in Ohio, should you ever want it, which is questionable.
There's a good chance of me going there. The Lions Led by Donkeys comes up on your podcast once in a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you both listeners or?
Yeah, I used to listen to it more. Now I like kind of go in spurts where I'll like kind of forget about it and then I'll listen to like three or four episodes.
So on their Discord, they share it with Hellboy to Die, but I think it's because Joe is from Michigan and mm-hmm. like they have their famous rivalry with Ohio. So all the people who get banned from the server are like placed under a channel called Exile to Ohio. So when I finally inevitably get banned from that server, I will be in Ohio. So yeah, I'll have to go to Kelly's Island.
So Kelly's Island is out actually in the lake. Johnson's Island is actually inside, like basically the entrance to Sandusky Bay.
Yeah.
Which puts it right by Cedar Point. It is like literally just right across from in the bay from Cedar Point, where the amusement park is.
See, initially I was thinking I don't Cedar Point of this diversion, but now I understand.
Yeah, you can enjoy living large in Sandusky, Ohio.
Yeah, wasn't Sandusky like? Wasn't he one of the people involved in?
Are you thinking of Jerry Sandusky?
Yeah, it's not named after him, is it?
It is not named after Jerry Sandusky.
Okay, yeah. I think it's like, it's just such a, like, it's a very specific name that, like, as soon as you hear that, you're like, oh, that's a bad vibes name. Like,
it is one that kind of like, before any of that with Penn State happened, like, I would have just immediately thought of the city in Ohio. And now I just immediately think of child sex abuse. So that's not good.
Fuck, that shouldn't come up twice.
No.
Okay, wait. Oh, so that was the scandal, that was in Pennsylvania then.
Yeah, it was Penn State University.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a whole... Is that one state over? Do they touch? I don't really know.
Yeah, the eastern border of Ohio, the flat part of Ohio is the western flat part of...
I thought like all of Ohio was the flat part of Ohio.
Well, it's round on both ends and high in the middle.
Well, this concludes Ohio chat.
Do you get it? Do you get it?
Something. Wait, what?
Ohio. It's high in the middle, Ohio.
Oh,
and
fuck,
it's round on both ends.
Is that like a local joke or did you make that up?
Yeah, it is. That's a thing people say about Ohio.
All right. Well, I guess you have to have something to do in Ohio. Anyway, fuck Ohio. That's what I've been told to believe. So I choose to believe it. Haven't been there. So Tanner, you're here once again from Beyond the Breakers. Do you want to quickly tell us what that is?
Sure. Beyond the Breakers is basically a shipwreck podcast, but we cover shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. So we try to have a good mix of times and places. So sometimes we'll go pretty far back into history. The farthest back we've gone is the White Ship disaster in England in like the 1100s. And then, you know, some of them are just a few years ago. So we like to cover a different, try to cover some lesser known ones while mixing in some of the big names that everyone is going to know, you know, stuff like the Lusitania, the Edmund Fitzgerald. We are committed to never doing an episode about the Titanic. That's been done. There are whole podcasts about the Titanic, so we're never going to do that. But there's a lot of great shipwreck stories, and we kind of just like that. You know, that there really are no two shipwrecks that are exactly the same. So there's a lot of good stories that go into each of them, and the impacts that they have on, you know, kind of where they are, where they exist in history.
Yeah, and when you say we, you have an alleged brother and co-podcaster who has not yet been proven to exist, but do you want to throw any slanderous reasons for why he's not here?
We are two brothers who make a podcast. Taylor's the only reason the podcast exists. He has always been the shipwreck person. I never had a particular interest in shipwrecks before we started making the show. This is our fourth season making it. But Taylor made the mistake of having three children. So he has stuff to do with them a lot, especially in the summer, you know, when they're home a lot more of the time, so...
And he doesn't have time for a four-part podcast recording?
Mm-hmm.
That's weird.
It's really a lot of that, especially in the summer. I mean, I have a pretty normal, you know, 9-to-5 type job 7-ish to 5-ish, I guess, as a teacher. So it's a bit easier for me to do some of the extra duties when it comes to, you know, dealing with Canadians and things of that nature.
Well, but Taylor did go on a Failure to Launch with you, which is a very good episode.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun getting to do something a bit like a shipwreck, but happening in space.
So the only conclusion is that Taylor hates me personally.
It's possible.
Or maybe just Quinn is just in on this. This is what I think is happening. Because, like, oh, the one person who can, you know, be able to theoretically say, oh, no, I saw a video of this guy. He's not just a voice. I saw it in Riverside. He's just got to be bought off, right?
We did also both go on the Spooky Science Sisters podcast to talk about the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
But was there video?
Yeah, you know what?
Were you on what?
I think we may have had our cameras off for that one. So it's possible he doesn't exist.
Also, I've never listened to that podcast. So for all I know, this is just more part of the, this is just more lies you're feeding me.
It's very true. This is going to be like the, I don't know which Call of Duty it is, but you go through the whole campaign and then like you realize the guy you're playing with doesn't actually exist.
Don't you hate when media lies to you from the very beginning and then tricks you at the end and feels really smug about it?
Mm-hmm. Like the Dark Tower series, Stephen King. Although that's not really a trick, I guess. Have you read that?
No.
All right. Well, I won't say any more because big spoiler.
But anyway, we are we're here doing Confederate blockade running. We're still in Nova Scotia, so I've still got my Nova Scotian beer. And we're talking about, I foreshadowed at the end of part one that we were going to sink a ship called the Caledonia. Mm-hmm. So the Caledonia was a paddle wheel steamer, and it was another Confederate blockade runner, which in practice was owned by a merchant in South Carolina. On paper, however, it was much better for these ships to be owned by people outside the Confederacy, like British citizens living in British North America, for example. It was Thomas's name then that was on the title and the insurance paperwork.
Mm.
And I guess since people are possibly listening to this a week apart, that is William King Thomas, sort of the central character that we saw in part one. There's no real evidence to suggest that Thomas did anything to cause the wreck of the ship, but when it did wreck on its first voyage for its owner, he did collect a handsome payout on the $32,000 insurance policy. That's the 1864 or so money.
Oh, so that's a lot of money.
Yeah, because just offhand, I know his $60,000 was like a million today, so it's about half. So it's like half a million, something like that.
Okay.
Well, I think well over half a million today. And again, just to reiterate, we are doing everything in U.S. dollars for contemporary money. So importantly, he would clearly learn from this incident going forward, whether that was intentional or not. And I've thrown a lot of names at you so far. Most of them are pretty one and done characters in the story, but we do need to weave back in one Patrick Martin. He was briefly introduced as a Montreal-based peer of Thomas and a member of the famed Fancy French Lady Caper. And in October 1864, he would get a visit from a relatively important man, a well-regarded stage performer in town on a 10-day tour.
Is it? Oh, my God. Is it? Never mind.
It is not Mark Wahlberg. He was not born yet.
Oh, I was going to guess John Wilkes Booth.
Well, pretend you didn't.
God damn it.
So he's performing a few one-man shows along the way. I have to read all this fucking bullshit. Obviously, I don't expect you to be familiar with the popular culture of the 1860s, but at the time, rest assured, he was a pretty big deal. Now imagine how tantalized you would be if you hadn't guessed. So acting aside, he had another plot he wanted to pitch Martin on. Martin had people in Maryland that could help pull it off. The plan: kidnap Abraham Lincoln, sneak him from sympathetic home to sympathetic home like a bizarro underground railroad all the way to Virginia, then ransom him for something. Sources vary on whether it was the release of Confederate POWs or ending the war on favorable terms for the South, but it's entirely possible that that was more of a consideration for later on. And while they were at it, Martin may as well help him get his expensive theatrical wardrobe, valued at a total of $25,000, 1864 money, from Montreal down to Virginia as well, where he envisioned himself performing thereafter, living in the lap of luxury as a Confederate hero. Perhaps history might even remember the name of this John Wilkes Booth. Dramatic reveal, yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
And then, you know, dramatic reveal of this image of John Wilkes Booth performing in Julius Caesar.
It's so interesting with John Wilkes Booth, like the fact that, kind of like you said there, with like the entertainment, the pop culture of the day is like, obviously he has become more famous to us for this other thing that he did.
It's like that footnote for the Unabomber's math stuff, better known for later work. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like you really do forget that, like, this guy was famous for other reasons. And so, like, I think in a previous episode when we talked about it, it came up and it was like, yeah, it would be like if you looked at you opened up Twitter and it's like, Tom Cruise killed the president. What?
Yeah.
Or like Brad Pitt or someone.
I'm still going to go with Mark Wahlberg, honestly.
Mark Wahlberg. That may have been the person that we used in the episode. We like to talk about Mark Wahlberg.
Although if Mark Wahlberg had been in Ford's Theater, it would not have gone down that way.
There would have been a lot of blood in that. There was already a lot of blood in the theater, I guess. There would have been more blood in that theater. I think it's also interesting is that John's brother, I think his name was Edwin?
Yeah. He was like a big union guy and like they hated each other.
And he was also like a super famous actor. I think he was probably more famous than John was. So maybe John is like Casey Affleck. And
I thought we were going to go with John as Donnie Wahlberg.
I should have gone that route, but
yeah. Casey Affleck killed the president. You know, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know much about Casey Affleck, but I feel like he could do it.
He did kill Jesse James in the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford.
So he's learned how to kill.
Trained to kill from birth.
Yeah. I'm trying to make a joke about Alec Baldwin killing the president, but it feels like that's in bad taste, so we'll move on.
It was an accident. He did not know the gun was even loaded.
Has anyone ever tried that with like a major high-profile assassination?
I didn't know it was going to do that.
I think Booth should have tried that. I think that would have gone better for him.
The guy who shot at Trump just being like, I'm really far away. This was the only thing I had that would let me see the president closer.
So how did William King Thomas figure into this? Well, he came into some kind of ownership stake in ships like the Caledonia via the Lamars. That is the trying to restart the transatlantic slave trade in 1858 Lamars. According to the book's author, Anne Larrabee, through the Lamars, he was also tied into a pair of schooners, and Thomas's idea was for Martin himself to ride along, again, that supercargo concept we discussed earlier. This idea was apparently not popular with Martin's loved ones. This passage explains why.
Any seasoned mariner knew that the sudden, treacherous gales of November brought freezing hurricane-force winds and blinding whiteouts that drove ships crashing ashore, for there was nowhere to run on the seaway during such a storm.
Gales of November mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I looked pretty extensively into how exactly this went down, and to be honest, Anne Larrabee may have gotten a bit carried away here. She says in her notes that her retelling of Martin's story is based primarily on the writings of a journalist she finds credible, but the account is definitely contentious, at least as far as exactly how closely Martin, Booth, and Thomas were all connected. One of the most noteworthy claims she makes is that there were two schooners involved, although she can only name one, the Marie Victoria. All retellings that I was able to access say that this one wrecked along the St. Lawrence River, with Booth's wardrobe inside. We know this because it was salvaged and the contents auctioned. Everywhere else I read about Martin suggests that he died on this voyage. Larrabee says he disappears on the other schooner, but gives no further details, and I never saw anyone else mention a second vessel. Either way, there are no accounts of either survivors or dead from the Marie Victoria wreck. We simply know that it left Montreal on October 24th and was found abandoned on November 7th, and Booth's clothes were ruined. Once again, eat shit.
Even worse. It's like my clothes. Also, I just have I'm just curious about this. Do Canadians pronounce the city Montreal instead of Montreal?
My belief around pronunciation is that, like, pronounce it to the best of your knowledge using phonemes that are in your language.
That is a perfect example of how I would describe, you know, pronunciation. There's no need to go whole hog into a French word in the middle of your English sentence.
Yeah. So if I were like speaking French, I would say like it's a nasalized vowel, Montréal.
Mm-hmm.
My last name ends in M-O-N-T. It's the same, like, root word, mon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I anglicize it to go mo. Like, it's just, it's the closest thing in English.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed this when I was talking to people, like, in countries I was traveling, and I can't remember exactly which ones, but people in some of these places I was in like, Central Asia and around there who had heard of it would just say, like, oh, yeah, I know this one city in Canada, like, Montreal. I'm like, well, that is a way better anglicization.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been trying to like teach myself to just say that instead, because I'm like, I speak French. I know better than to be like Montreal.
Montreal.
Like, that is how everyone pronounces it. But I am being a pretentious knob and I'm just like, no, I could say Montreal. Right. So yeah, this is kind of an interesting situation where, like, I don't know how you can't account for an entire second ship. Like the example at the beginning where we were talking about like the difference between like subjective interpretation of history versus whether a boat sank, but like we can't even agree on whether a second boat sank.
There's plenty of stories that we've done where it's like there's small discrepancies where when it's like 208 or 202 ships, when it's two or one, like potentially twice as many, that is a big difference.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't entirely matter. We just kind of, we know that like Martin did disappear and people kind of worked backward to suggest that like maybe Thomas was responsible for this. But again, there's also like, and Larrabee makes this clear too, like there's no evidence that he would have sabotaged these ships in any way. While we're questioning Larrabee's claims here, she makes an utterly baffling statement that concurrently with the Victoria incident, Thomas was hosting an infamous Confederate bank robber named Bennett Young, who just successfully eluded. You've heard of Bennett Young?
Did he do the, I forget the name of the town, but there was a bank robbery in.
Yes, it's exactly who it is.
Is that where we're going in the story or?
Yes.
Okay.
He had just successfully. Sorry, she claims that Thomas was hosting Bennett Young after he just successfully eluded authorities after participating in a surprising raid on the town of St. Albans, Vermont. After checking several other sources, I kind of got to say, in the most academic terms I can, there is simply no fucking way this happened. Not like the bank robbery absolutely happened, yeah. But there's no way he was even in Halifax. So if we turn again to Claire Hoy's Canadians in the Civil War, we're told that Young was captured in dramatic fashion around Freiligsburg, Quebec, about 43 kilometers from St. Albans on modern roads. And I will not translate to your fucking miles. I draw the line there. About 43 kilometers from St. Albans on modern roads, which is less than 24 hours later. Halifax, you will note if you look at a map, is 750 kilometers away as the crow flies in a straight line. That's well over 1,000 kilometers, or more than 1 megameter, if you prefer.
Ooh, nice.
Traveling overland today. The most charitable read is that she meant one of Young's party that wasn't caught, but even the source I found on that would only say some accounts say they fled to Halifax in the spring. Mm-hmm. So I'm fucked if I could tell you what Anne Larrabee was thinking here.
Also, 43 kilometers is 26.7 miles. So
Bennett Young was released back into Canada at the end of all that, but that again didn't happen until the spring. So like he could have gone to Halifax, but it's like, she gives so little detail in any of this other than to just quickly claim he definitely like hosted him while he was on the run. And it was like, he wasn't even on the run. Like he got arrested, taken to Montreal, and then just like released. Mm-hmm. That's why it's what made me increasingly skeptical. I'm like, I can't even say she's being meticulous. Like I do not know what she was going for there.
Being detailed, but not necessarily meticulous about those details.
Yeah. It's interesting how some of this stuff changes because it's so much easier to fact check now. Like I could pull up both of these books I'm naming here on the Internet Archive for free. The Internet Archive is fucking incredible, but you can, even with how fucked, you know, Google is these days, like you can search, you can find a few websites, check stories together. Like a lot of the work the author had to do for this book is like flying to Germany and going to an archive and pulling papers manually. I actually wanted to fact check some of the stuff from the archive, and there is like the one of the archives she used like has a website, but you can't. Like not all the stuff is actually digitized. Mm-hmm. Like I say, the author did do a lot of legwork. There's just a lot of these parts where I kind of side eye it. And I'm like,
It's like I was reading through a book for a bonus episode. It mentioned the SS Henry Steinbrenner being built in 1907. And I sat bolt upright in my chair and I said, the Steinbrenner was built in 1901. What is this? And so I like double checked myself, made sure that I had my stuff right. Could not find any other Steinbrenner that was built at this time. But it's like the book I was reading from is from 1977. So it's like, yeah, it's like there's no quick fact checking going on. It's like you'd probably have to get up and go somewhere if you wanted to double check this at the time.
There's so many ways that can go wrong. Like if somebody like, if you had like an assistant who's a research assistant and they just like typoed a 7 instead of a 1, and then you're like, great, my assistant did great work. And then it's like a telephone game of,
or like the 7 and the 1. It's like that easily could just be like a printing error. Like something looks a bit wrong that. So
yeah, this is also part of why it took me so long to put this all together, because there were so many little like, I'll do a quick fact check on this. And then it was like 6 hours later. A more likely scenario, in my opinion, is that Thomas lied about being connected to the raid at one point, and Larrabee took it as a fact for whatever reason, which is odd because when he lies about being near the 1861 Camp Jackson massacre that took place just outside St. Louis, or if I was, you know, again, being very pedantic, St. Louis. Although there's not a lot of French speakers left there, so.
Not many.
Larrabee rightly calls this out as nonsense from a fabulist, which, yeah, like this guy is, like his, the whole reason we're reading about him is because he was a liar, I think is also worth noting here. So back to Patrick Martin and the Marie Victoria. Larrabee speaks to speculation of intentional sabotage on Thomas's part for reasons that will become clearer later. However and why ever the ship, or ships, truly went down, Thomas was the one left to claim the insurance on the losses, aided by the convenient testimony of British soldiers in Montreal to the insurance company that they had seen Martin embark on the ship, or ships. Here we can see how the author uses this opportunity to really flex her prose.
This proved to the satisfaction of the insurance agents that Martin had not absconded, but was in fact dead. Thomas collected Martin's claim, as much as $100,000, refusing to give any of it over to Martin's wife and daughter, who had no legal recourse and were left destitute. Despite his amiable facade, William King Thomas was a cold man, possessed by his secret ambition and immune to the pleas of women.
Yeah, so like, she does this a lot. As soon as she gets the opportunity to get into a character's head like this, she's just very confidently like, and she's upfront about it being, what'd she say, narrative nonfiction. Mm-hmm. But like very definitively like, well, he was like cold, he was heartless, he had secret ambition, he was immune to the pleas of women. I was like, I think he was a scammer, yeah.
Being so confident about someone's secret ambition takes a lot of confidence there. Immune to the pleas of women. Focus on money, be immune to the pleas of women. This sounds like a young man's guide to success, I would say.
Yeah. And speaking of the pleas of women, during his time in the city, Thomas also managed to woo a different sort of mark, Mary Clifton, a chambermaid at the Halifax Hotel. They would eventually wed, a decision which would change her life irrevocably. Thomas swindles his way right up until he took Mary out of Halifax, leaving a trail of fraudulent bank receipts, and on to their next home. The Big Apple, baby!
Love
New York
Mets.
City!
Love the Mets!
I'm scamming here! And what better way to jump into the Fame Metropolis than to go off with some absolutely baffling prose, again from The Fiend.
In Horatio Alger's classic tale of a poor boy's rise to riches, Ragged Dick takes his country friend, I almost said fiend, takes his country friend on a tour around New York, showing him all the magnificent buildings in Manhattan. "That's Taylor's Saloon," says Dick. "When I come into a fortune, I shall take my meals there regular."
I'm not sure how you're supposed to pronounce fortune with apostrophe on the end.
Fortune.
"When I come into a fortune, I shall take my meals there regular." That's kind of how I was reading it.
"Hey, when I'm loving the Mets, I'll take my meals there. Hey." Let's see. Taylor's Saloon on Broadway, an elegant dining place with two grand entrances opening into a sea of marble with fountains and faux Greek statues brilliantly lit by 100 gas jets. Next to 10-foot-long windows with fabulous views of the city. Diners feasted on roast beef and drank sherry cobbler, a sugary alcoholic punch made with pineapples and oranges. There, late at night, young women were rumored to meet their ruin, either because their wooers made insincere offers or because the vanilla ice cream gave them such ecstatic pleasure.
Yeah, you know, when you have a little too much ice cream, you end up doing some, you know, things you regret.
You get that chocolate syrup on there and it's game over there.
Yeah, you walk in on some unvetted suitor feeding your daughter some ice cream. It's like, what's this?
What's all this? I was just confused reading it. It's like drank sherry cobbler. I was just imagining like a cobbler just sort of like jammed into a glass of sherry and sort of just like sipping on that.
Yeah, like I say, I kept that part because I'm just like, there's just a lot of fascinating word choices, I think, going on. I don't know. Maybe this is more about the author's relationship to vanilla ice cream than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas's journey to the U.S. this time around was not without its snags. The Union government had, in 1862, shrewdly decided to pressure the British authorities in Canada to issue passports in order to cut down on that pesky Confederate terrorism. So I think this was a super fun fact. The Canadian passport, like specific to Canada, it wasn't just like a British passport, predates Canada as a like technical country.
Interesting.
Yeah. In December 1864, Thomas dutifully applied for one, but as astute listeners may recall, he had already been reported as a terrorist by the local American consul, who wisely refused to countersign the document. This is very funny that, like, the guy who had to sign off on his passport is the guy who, like, reported him to the government. This consul also alerted the United States Department of War that this was happening. So faced with this insurmountable administrative challenge, Thomas outdid his nemesis with an even more masterful gambit. He crossed the border anyway under a fake name.
That's a way to do it. These illegals are flooding over our border, and they're committing acts of terrorism.
God.
I hate to see it.
I was born the wrong century, man. I want to do shit like this. On his way to New York, where he told his friends he was headed to finally reclaim that lost pork, Thomas met up with Mary in Boston.
Hey, I'm Boston here.
I don't know.
Wait, how old is this pork now?
Well, we've been jumping kind of back and forth. This
okay.
Because I did all the ship-related stuff first.
Kinda. Okay.
So I think all of this, I think the pork and this all happened in 1864.
I was thinking, like, I don't want it now. If it's a month old.
Yeah, I don't know how many months it is, but they got all that ice. I don't know.
That's true. Probably a lot of salt.
Yeah, I mean, it's all, you know, beef jerky now, or pork jerky.
Mm-hmm.
So Thomas met up with Mary in Boston. While they were there, he worked in one quick shipping scam as a treat. Using his Confederate connections, he managed to somehow arrange for a shipment of Southern cotton to transit through the port on its way to Glasgow and forged paperwork to offload the cargo when it reached Boston, which it promptly sold, with the intended recipients in Scotland still expecting the goods to arrive on the ship he'd unloaded it from. Thomas pocketed another $5,000 before moving on to New York.
I just like the as a treat bit. It's like you're just like on vacation with your wife, honey. You said no scams.
You said no scams.
It's like, come on. I just wanted just one little one.
Just it's been so long. It's my birthday.
I haven't scammed in weeks.
You know it. You know, if I don't scam often enough, like, it could hurt me. I could cause damage to me. Do you understand that?
If you don't let me scam, I might have to go find someone who will. So.
Oh, foreshadowing. So, you know, the scammers of today, I mean, maybe they are just as lazy, but, like, I have nothing but contempt for, like, the Sam Bankman-Frieds of the world who just, like, write, like, wire fraud all over their, you know, their WhatsApp group chats and then just do the most, like, obvious shit and then, you know, and then it's like, well, yeah, you did the thing you said you were doing and you just, like, you didn't keep any records. But then this guy's like, I feel like there's just a certain boldness.
And also, it's kind of like when you watch an older movie, even one from, like, even something that's not super old, from like the 70s or 80s, and you think, like, wow, the whole plot of this movie would be unraveled by, like, someone having a smartphone.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of the same thing with these old-timey hucksters where it's like, yeah, like, you could do these grand scams, and then, like, if you got caught, like, as long as you didn't end up in prison, it's like, you could move, like, three counties over and do the same thing.
100%. Yeah. Like, you go, like, this is why he does on vacation. He goes to Boston. He steals a bunch of stuff off a boat. He's gone from Boston before, like, the boat is even past Halifax.
Yeah.
And then it's like, there's these guys in Scotland who are like, what the fuck is an empty boat? And it's like, what are you going to do? Are you going to go find this guy?
Like, yeah. It's like, when it takes weeks for anyone to know that anything has happened, it's like, so easy to scam.
The thing is, like, this, all this stuff was written down because there was reason to read up on this guy. Like, how many people do you think just did this and then just, like, they pocketed $5,000, maybe they do one or two scams in their life, and that they, and then they just retired.
I'm out.
Or they just simply never got caught. Like, how much was built in to the losses of these companies where they're like, yeah, you're going to have some shrinkage. You're going to have some $5,000 scams.
I think a lot of your scammers, though, are in it for the love of the game. So I think it'd be harder than it sounds to just do a couple successful ones and then stop. Because then you're thinking, like, God, I could do it again. It was so easy.
Yeah, and you may be foreshadowing again, but...
It's just like gambling. It's just like gambling where, you know, when you win money, you know you're going to win more. So you keep doing it, and you keep doing it.
Yeah, very much so. Like, the thing that made you so bold in the first place, like, is what makes you succeed is also your undoing.
Right.
I think that's a very, like, common thread in a lot of history.
Could call it, I guess, is what you'd call, like, a tragic flaw in a character from a story.
Yeah. Again, we've thrown a bunch of numbers around. You might be wondering, how much money did he have at this point? There's no good way to pin down an exact answer. The book estimates kind of between 150 and 300,000 as the losses of his collective victims back then. So between 3 and 6 million USD today. That's their losses, right? Not necessarily what he pocketed. Mm-hmm. She doesn't cite specific sources on who made those estimates. And there's a lot of confounding factors, like if people were exaggerating their losses or did he earn money just through straightforward blockade running, right? Like that was not a legitimate business, but it wasn't a scam so much as it was just like
a thing that you could do. Like,
it was blocking, it was doing some form of almost legitimate trade through a blockade. Mm-hmm. And like how many dollars in profit did he make every time an investor lost a dollar? But it kind of gives us at least a proxy to infer like he had the means to line his pockets, as we're saying, walk off in the sunset and retire somewhere quiet. But he doesn't do this. Mm-hmm. For one thing, he's bad with his money. According to the man himself, again, take it with a grain of salt, he lost $100,000 alone in bad speculative investments. True or not, he and his wife certainly did not live humbly or quietly. This was not in his best interest, not just for financial reasons, as you might imagine. He left a trail of angry marks in his wake, and they would be looking for him. A ship's pilot named Robert Grissom, who worked for the Lamars, slaver Lamars, and lost $4,000 to Thomas personally, was also backed by the jilted pork investor Norman Walker as he attempted to hunt the swindler down. He nearly succeeded as a hired private eye managed to track Thomas to the aforementioned Taylor's saloon, but not nearly quickly enough. Thomas skipped town again and fled to St. Louis, where a French friend was willing to take him in. They claimed to be cousins, both taking the same fake surname, despite Thomas clearly presenting as British. At the same time, Mary, to her chagrin, became pregnant with twins. This was a particularly pernicious situation as she was still in New York, and as you may have guessed, Thomas never went back for her. He did manage to bring all their money with him, however, leaving her to work again as a chambermaid just to scrape together enough for passage back home to Halifax. Meanwhile, Thomas continued to live in luxury, absconding on a first-class train and continuing to live the high life wherever he went. So, like, less charming.
Right. So you're telling me that this swindler who's working with the Confederacy is a bad guy?
Unfortunately, the needle might be moving that direction, but we'll see where it goes.
Okay.
He wrote at the end of the Civil War in St. Louis, far from its major concluding events, although that does not stop Larrabee from taking an extremely large swing regarding our friend John Wilkes Booth's eventual assassination of President Lincoln.
The loss of his expensive theatrical wardrobe, with no insurance compensation, could not have helped Booth's state of mind. He played only three major theatrical roles in the months after leaving Montreal. Montreal. And immersing himself in violent, obsessive plotting for what he called the sharpest play ever done in America. I was almost laughing through that because, like, the way that it said it couldn't have helped his state of mind, I'm just imagining him, like, stewing in his room and, like, thinking about killing Abraham Lincoln, and then, like, he gets a note that says, like, dude, your clothes are lost, and he's just like, I'm gonna do it!
Yeah.
I'm gonna do it!
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Or like, or he's doing like the old version of like, thanks, Obama, where it's like, sir, your clothes are ruined. Thanks, Lincoln.
Thank you. Yeah.
That's what really puts him on the path. That was his radicalizing moment. It's like, my wardrobe. This wouldn't have happened in like, who did he run against? I shouldn't know this.
In 1864, he ran against McClellan, George McClellan.
This wouldn't have happened in McClellan's America.
If McClellan was him and the Democrats had won, this wouldn't have happened.
I mean, that's kind of true because he was probably performing in Canada in part because he couldn't really perform in the North, or he didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just such like a generous interpretation to be like, wow, like, you know, losing his wardrobe couldn't have like...
It couldn't have helped things, right?
It couldn't have helped, yeah.
It's like, you got to have a little sympathy for the guy. I mean, he lost all his acting clothes.
Like, again, very expensive wardrobe, but...
I know you're upset you lost your clothes. We don't shoot the president because we lost our clothes, do we? No, we don't, John.
Yeah, I started to think John Wilkes Booth was a bad role model. Like, you know, maybe he could have managed his anger and turned it into art.
Mm-hmm.
So the author also tells us that another detective manages to track Thomas to St. Louis in part due to his distribution of his photographic carte de visite, or his like visitation card, all around. Not an uncommon practice, and certainly plausible, as Thomas then ran off again to a remote Illinois town called Highland, which for people who aren't like super geography nerds, Highland is like extremely close to St. Louis, which is on the border of the two states.
Mm-hmm.
His time spent in this exile of sorts out on the prairie is not particularly conducive to making a podcast that's ostensibly about shipwrecks, so good thing we're not, So we can gloss over a lot of it. Larrabee uses the episode to wax on a lot with the world building and characterization, but it's worth mentioning that Highland was heavily settled by Swiss immigrants, and in this environment, he began to learn German. This will be relevant later.
He began to learn weird, fucked up German.
Actually, yes, that will also be relevant later.
Okay.
It's also in Highland that Thomas, more than over his faintly charming love story with Mary, engaged in one of his worst crimes of all, a problematic age gap. Thomas, about 38 at the time, got together with a 20-year-old daughter of French immigrants named Cecilia Paris. Again, like a very on-the-nose name. It's like, oh, I need a fake French name. Cecilia Paris.
Cecilia. You see a map on the wall. Paris. Hmm.
Yeah. And Larrabee describes her like this.
As she was growing up, Cecilia had learned the art of bonnet making. Her mother became the imperious proprietor of her own shop on St. Louis's downtown North 4th Street, and was well known for actually being French. Nearly all milliners in the country pretended they had fashionable Parisian origins, taking on the fine airs of Madame. But Louise was a real bona fide Madame Paris. Cecilia came to this independent, creative female household to provide another skillful hand, but she often expressed dissatisfaction with her own life and imagined herself as sequestered, shut off from the world by great tracts of woodland and ranges of hills. Like many a teenage neurasthenic, she claimed she was dying of consumption, that romantic disease of European poets, musicians, and women in unrequited love. She would marry a rich man, she confided to her friends, and live a short and merry life.
Goths never change, man.
I just like how thinking of consumption as a romantic disease, and like I get the connection, but at the same time, it's like hacking your lungs out, like is very romantic.
Yeah, it's tuberculosis. It's the you actually get tuberculosis, and you're just like basically like drowning in your own lungs, and then it's like wow, like oh god, he's so edgy, like he's so cool. Yeah, I also had to look up the word neurasthenic.
Is it like a what do we call them now? Hypochondriac?
That's, I think so, yeah. So I grabbed the Oxford English Dictionary definition here. An ill-defined medical condition characterized by lassitude, fatigue, headache, and irritability associated chiefly with emotional disturbance. So being a teenager.
So I was saying, is it like a word they would use for teenagers in the same way that like hysteria is used to describe women in many of these old time things?
Maybe. It's this one and like I think a couple other quotes where like it's worth noting that like she wrote this book in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's like she kind of has this very like old timey prosaic way of writing sometimes when it's like you were like 40 in 2002. Like you're not like from the 19th century.
Still probably very affected by the events of 9/11. Probably not in the best headspace. So,
okay. So in the intro to the book, she mentions 9/11.
Oh,
if we are feeling energetic, we can talk about the end. But basically she's like, yeah, I had to get on a plane to like go to somewhere to like visit an archive, and 9/11 had just happened, and they was like, all right, this is just a very like of its time. Yeah. So further down, there's an even better description of Cecilia's mother, and I do not care if this depiction of Cecilia's mother is true. It rules.
In the gossipy climate of a small town, even the most personal crisis could not go unnoticed. Nor did the neighbors fail to observe the unusual behavior of Madame Paris when she first came down from St. Louis to visit her daughter. Then, they heard loud arguments, Madame's angry shrieks rattling the window panes and driving the cat from the house. The dog, they remembered, escaped with half a tail, never to return. When Madame came back a second time, she was given a ride by a local farmer, who did not know who she was. The farmer amiably began to gossip about a former visitor to the Thomases, a restless old snoozer, with a voice so loud it could shatter the ears of a mule. Her manner was so imperious, he went on, that if she gestured to the cows, they would voluntarily offer their hides to her. Madame recognized herself in this description and laid into the farmer, grabbing his beard and yanking out his whiskers, calling him a hairless old pumpkinhead and the muddle-brained grandson of a lunatic. She threatened to reach down his throat, jerk out his intestines, and throw them over the Blue Ridge.
That's the only way to deal with the muddle-brained grandson of a lunatic.
Oh, great.
That's so good. Outside of that, William King Thomas and his new wife, Cecilia, did well for themselves, indulging in an affluent socialite lifestyle, until late 1865, when Thomas finally began to properly enter the finding out phase of this story. Do you remember kind of what he looked like in 1860? I'll throw it back up in the edit for people to look at, but
this is the Tucker Carlson picture, right? The Tucker Carlson of Swanson Frozen Foods inheritance fame.
Yeah. So here is him and Cecilia 5 years later.
Oh.
Yeah, I feel like it's been a hard 5 years on him.
It looks like he has been surviving off of Swanson Frozen Foods.
Yeah. And now part of it, I think, when you look at this picture and you look back at the previous one of him, like, he has a prodigious comb over in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was already, like, pretty bald.
He was already fighting that battle. And
yeah, he's kind of, like, at least accepted here, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, yeah, he looks like he's just, like, seen some shit.
Here, I mean, he's hair-wise, he's got a bit of, like, it's a bit of, like, the George Costanza look, where he's got some on the sides, but the top is pretty much gone.
Mm-hmm.
His hands look puffier, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
It almost looks like he's wearing gloves, but he might be. I don't know.
I mean, and it's a hard life running all these scams, I think, and trying to keep track of them and run away from people. But
yeah.
Cecilia, on the other hand,
she looks pretty good, I think.
Yeah. I mean, she's like 20s. Like, she doesn't have the opportunity to be dragged down by the weight of the world yet.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is also a very, like, this photo, like, she's going for a look. Like, mm-hmm. She's trying to look fashionable. Like, she's got that, like, that, you know, that pouty, gloomy face going.
Yeah, very stern looking. Probably makes her look a bit older than she actually is.
Well, I think this is still the area we have to look stern for a photo, because it takes, like, 10 minutes and you can't smile.
Yeah.
Like I said, the finding out phase. One of his gravest mistakes was that as he was telling his spurned lover, Mary, he would send for her when he could, he told her where he was going. So she evidently knew enough of his dealings, because it's not clear how much she would have known about the scams. But she evidently knew enough of his dealings to know who to reach out to once it was apparent that he had fully abandoned her. Namely, one of the marks of his great locomotive scam, Luther Rice Smoot.
All right.
Informed by Mary that he had made for St. Louis, Smoot sent Thomas's carte de visite via his cousin to a local detective, who recognized the picture and was more than happy to apprehend the man for a reward. Smoot rode down to meet the detective, and the two proceeded to Illinois, where they picked up another companion, the local U.S. Marshal, who would draw up a proper arrest warrant for Thomas. The grounds for doing so were that Smoot arguably had a leg to stand on legally. Thomas had fraudulently taken his money for a legitimate purchase, the two locomotives still in the possession of U.S. Customs. One small sticking point was that buying machinery to move cotton for the Confederate States of America might not be considered a legitimate purpose in the eyes of the state, but Smoot was more than prepared to pretend that he had tried to obtain them for normal, non-shady reasons. And it's worth noting that, like, the other investors in this locomotive scam had, like, they didn't, as far as we know, didn't pursue him. The one company was just like, write it off as a loss, as we were kind of getting at. And then the other single investor is just like, I think she says in the book, like, that it, like, ruined his life. Yeah. Because, again, like, he's losing, like, I don't know, like, it was, yeah, like, 50,000 in whatever in the at that time. Like, the guy lost so much money on this scam.
Mm-hmm.
And so you understand why this guy is absolutely hell-bent getting his money back.
Right, right.
So, again, reminder, the Civil War is over now. As far as Smoot's personal legal standing in the eyes of the now only remaining U.S. government, he had received a full amnesty and pardon in October of 1865, under a few conditions, one of which was that he would never reclaim confiscated property. Since his petitions insisted that the property had not been confiscated appropriately, he evidently felt comfortable trying to thread this needle legally. But he likely suspected this avenue was a long shot, hence the hedging of his bets by attempting to get satisfaction from Thomas directly. Larrabee points out that he, a pro-slavery and anti-immigration Confederate, he was, like, from, like, he was involved, like, the Know Nothing Party and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Marshal, a strongly pro-Union officer who broke up Northern secessionist cells and corresponded with Lincoln personally, were quite the odd couple on this mission. However, you may be familiar with the grand unifying theory of fuck that guy, which is certainly in play here. The three tracked Thomas down and cornered him where he was staying in Highland, where Smoot demanded his money. Although Thomas insisted, I'm broke, can't pay you. He was apprehended nonetheless, and the foursome now made their way back to St. Louis with the intent of bringing Thomas into the police station. What they didn't know, however, was that Thomas was carrying a revolver. What happens next is probably not what you'd expect. Thomas indicated to his captors that he had the weapon, declaring, "My God, I've got a great mind to blow my brains out now." So they took his gun away and continued to the station.
All right.
All right. Problem solved.
I'm really going to do it, guys.
Yeah. Massive, massive drama queen. After they got there, Thomas tried his best to negotiate his way out, changing his story of whether he had any money or not. This was Thomas attempting to use a tried and true tactic to get out of custody, namely, being insanely fucking annoying. Smoot was certainly annoyed, so he pulls the move of, okay, if you will play ball with me, I'm going to go get my cool, tough friend. Then you'll be sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, the buddy Smoot pulls is a strange mismatch. I would go as far as to say that this contact was about as staunchly pro-union as they come. But when you need a cool, tough friend in 1865, who do you go get?
Ulysses Grant.
Close. Your good buddy, William Tecumseh Sherman.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Sherman had a long history with St. Louis. At this time of our story, he was in the city at the head of a military division assigned to protect the westward expansion of the Pacific Railroad. Given that the war was over, someone a little less familiar with this time period might wonder, who exactly the railroad needed protection from?
the people who live on that land?
Yeah, the people who've lived there for like tens of thousands of years. So, like, this is not the point of the story, but, like, especially to me as somebody who's kind of, like, peripherally understanding of, like, American history, and I've maybe you've seen this online again. We see a lot of the same things. Like sometimes Sherman gets used as kind of like a mascot for people trash talking the Confederacy.
I was just going to bring this up, how people will change their profile pictures to Sherman and like, you know, cosplay as Sherman online. And it's like, if you ended history in like April 1865, I could kind of see this a little bit more.
Yes.
It's not really,
So you're familiar.
Yeah, he's not a great person to latch onto as your historical hero. If you consider Native Americans to be humans equal to, you know, you and me and everyone else.
So you are familiar with this?
Yes.
Yeah, because I really wasn't. I was like, oh yeah, Sherman, there's like memes about burning Atlanta. I learned through searching this up. Not great.
Grant and Sherman obviously have like this great partnership, but I think as people, Grant is one that like people who have a surface knowledge of Grant tend to kind of like lampoon him. Like they, oh, he's an alcoholic. Like he could barely win battles. Grant is one where I think the more you learn about Grant, the more you like him. Whereas Sherman is the opposite. You know, if you only know about him burning Atlanta, it's like, oh, cool. Yeah. Like kick ass. And then like when you read, you know, about his life post Civil War, it's like, oh yeah, this is a bad dude.
And since we are veering very far away from Canadian history and culture, we can tie this in here. This was just a very funny thing to me. Like, I don't know how you're not much of like hockey fans, are you? Or,
not really. I used to watch the Blackhawks, but
so not the recent team that was in Atlanta, but back in the '70s when the NHL expanded to Atlanta, do you know what they called the team?
The Shermans.
They called them the Atlanta Flames, named after the city being burned down.
Oh, no. Well,
which is such a baffling move, right?
Well, I will say that's more common, I guess, in sports than you'd think. Because, like, University of Miami, like, they're the Hurricanes. Chicago soccer team is the Chicago Fire.
Yeah, that's also very funny. It's the same deal. Like at least the Hurricanes are, like, Hurricanes are a cool force of nature. You want to embody that, like. The Atlanta Flames is like, we lost a battle. Other people did this.
That is really funny. I did not know that.
What's also funny is that when the Atlanta Flames relocated, because we apparently refused to learn the lesson that hockey does not work in Atlanta, when the Atlanta Flames moved to Calgary, they were like, yeah, it's a cool team name. We'll keep it. So now they're called the Calgary Flames because Atlanta burned.
I was going to ask about if that was the same franchise.
Yeah, 100% the same franchise. They were awesome. It's the only Canadian franchise that doesn't have some kind of like national or local reference in its name.
That's a bit like in the NBA, like the Utah Jazz just being called that because they moved.
That's a very funny one. I never like picked up on it until I was like,
or like the LA Lakers. I mean, moving from Minnesota.
It's so weird. And they just don't do that anymore. Like you don't keep team names. Like, so they recently, again, hugely tangential, but they moved the Phoenix/Arizona Coyotes to Utah after the last season.
Mm-hmm.
Coyotes is absolutely a name you could carry over, but instead they're like, well, no, we need to pick a new name. Nobody carries over team names anymore. Not since like, yeah, the 80s. We got to pick a new team name. And all the options were dog shit. And they're like, we're just going to be Utah Hockey Club for a season. And it's like, oh my God.
It worked for the Washington football team.
Yeah. They have such an amazing one in front of them. Like, again, a long time ago, nobody gave a shit about like, oh, like, we'll call a team the Lions. There's a lot of teams called the Lions, right? There's a Lions in the NFL and Lions in the CFL. Mm-hmm. There's a Cardinals in the here and there. There's Giants in two leagues. But now I think a lot of teams are more like protective of their copyright and will go after expansion other leagues. Because otherwise, the Utah Raptors is right there.
Mm, that would be cool. That'd be cool.
Right. It's like the most perfect name imaginable. It's literally a thing. The Utah Raptor. Mm-hmm. But like it's like it has to be because they don't want to step on the
Toronto.
Stupid.
Was it
the Toronto Raptor? Not a thing. Not a real dinosaur.
Was it Edmonton in the CFL who recently changed their name because it was not a great name?
Yes. They are the Elks now. Yeah. Okay. Anyway. Also, yeah, that's, I don't know. We can't get way too off topic. the answer was yes, that Sherman was protecting the railroad from indigenous people.
That's where we started this.
Yeah. This is just to kind of, I guess, fill in some of the details for people like me who weren't aware of this. So in 1866, the U.S. military suffered a horrendous military defeat at the hands of the Sioux, leading Sherman to telegraph to President Grant, quote, "I do not yet understand how the massacre of Colonel Fetterman's party could have been so complete. We must act with vindictive earnestness against the Sioux, even to their extermination, men, women, and children. Nothing less will reach the root of this case," end quote. And later in 1867, he would add, quote, "We are not going to let a few thieving, ragged Indians check and stop the progress of a work of national and worldwide importance," end quote.
Yeah.
To his brother John, he wrote in 1868, quote, "All who cling to their old hunting grounds are hostile and will remain so till killed off. From the nature of things, we must take chances and clean out Indians as we encounter them," end quote.
Why are these guys being so hostile?
Yes, exactly. There is also a follow-up to that second quote I think is very illustrative of how a lot of people thought at the time.
"This conflict of authority will exist as long as the Indians exist, for their ways are different from our ways, and either they or we must be masters on the plains. I have no doubt our people have committed grievous wrong to the Indians, and I wish we could punish them. But it is impracticable. But both races cannot use this country in common, and one or the other must withdraw. We cannot withdraw without checking the natural progress of civilization. The only course is for us to destroy the hostile and to segregate the peaceful and maintain them."
That's just so Weasley. Like, ugh, I wish we could punish them.
If only, I wish we could stop.
If only we could do something. If only me, the person in charge of the army, in charge of exterminating these people, could do something about what we did.
It's, yeah, I mean, it's
impracticable, guys. It's impracticable.
Yeah, it's like, it's one of those situations where it's like, I wish these guys did not make us have to kill them. But like, what are you going to do? I mean, we can't just, what are you going to not do it?
Yeah, what can you do? That's like truly the question of so many of this type of guy in history. Like, well, what else could we do?
Also, I believe John was, he was a senator, I think. So that was kind of a big connection for Sherman to like the U.S. government, even when he was like having a mental breakdown and falling apart and not really super highly trusted by his superiors. He had his brother who was a senator who kind of like kept everything cool, saying he's cool, guys. Don't panic.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. He goes on and on like this at least through 1873. So, yeah, that's why Sherman is in St. Louis in 1865.
Yeah.
He also had this quote about the Civil War itself, which I think is also just interesting in the face of like how he's used as a mascot. I don't know if you've heard this one, but he says, "If my name must go to history, I prefer it should not as the enemy to the South or any system of labor, which, however objectionable, has cleared the forest and corn breaks developed a wealth otherwise latent, but against mobs, vigilance committees, and other phases of sedition and anarchy, which have threatened and still endanger the country, which our children must inhabit." So he's literally doing like, I can excuse like defending slavery. Mm-hmm. I draw the line at breaking the law. I draw the line at breaking the union.
Yeah. I wasn't familiar with that quote. So I thought you were going to go towards like, I'd rather you remember me as like the guy who beat the Indians rather than the guy who beat the Confederacy. But
no, he's this guy who's like, make sure you put in the newspaper, I didn't oppose slavery.
Yeah. It's
yeah, so this guy sucks.
Yeah, Sherman really sucks. And then like Phil Sheridan, who's like famed, you know, cavalry commander for the Union, who really turns the tide of the cavalry war in the Civil War. And like he's kind of the same where he he takes over that spot from Sherman in like the Department of like the West. And he's an equally big, if not bigger, asshole.
Well, hopefully they didn't name anything after Sherman or Sheridan.
It would suck if there were very famous military vehicles named after these people.
Mm-hmm. But we're not talking about Sheridan. We're talking about Sherman. So Sherman's house was not too far away. So Smoot headed over and pled his case, asking for soldiers to help him go and shake Thomas down. Sherman's response, no, absolutely not. Thomas might have been a villain in Sherman's worldview, but the war was over, and that was not what soldiers were for. And this ends William Tecumseh Sherman's involvement in this story. So that's it for that. So Smoot gives up on Sherman, but he does not give up on Thomas, and he was unsurprisingly growing weary of incarceration. Only a few days after insisting, I got no money, he offered Smoot $5,000 to call it even, notably short of the $25,000 being sought. And again, that's 5,000 being like, what was the conversion rate? I didn't write that one down, but he's offering him like tens of thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, I found this in my pocket while you were over at Sherman's house.
I put on my different jacket and I found this.
Yeah, don't you love when you have enough to buy a house in your jacket pocket that you forgot about? Yeah, the $5,000, it's less than the $25,000 he's owed. Smoot knows that this initial officer is probably not all he has to give, so he holds out. And so, you know, now Thomas says, oh, I'll go borrow money from my fake French cousin.
Mm-hmm.
The two finally settle on $10,000 in bonds, with Thomas claiming this was more than half his life savings. $19,500, he told them. Together, they had another odd couple adventure as they went around town on New Year's Day trying to convince the local bank staff to open the vault on a holiday. And eventually, Smoot got his $10,000. Neither was particularly happy, as Smoot wanted to be made whole, and Thomas had actually been fully caught out for once. And while he'd still profited from the venture, he now had to face the reality that others might be coming to collect.
So they did like a soft bank robbery.
Well, like it is
his money.
Yeah.
But it's like forcing them to open the vault.
Yeah, it's like, hey, can you please open on a holiday? It's my birthday.
You wouldn't deprive a birthday boy of his money.
Yeah, there's nothing to suggest that he like did fake bank drafts this time. Like he gave him $10,000 because again he had what was it like probably $45,000 I think was what they work out, or I think after this he has $45,000. So like he's doing fine. He still wins on his scam, and it's like amazing that like he gets caught. He gets fully caught, like arrested by a police officer, and he just like bribes his way out of it because it's like I'll give you this much. So despite Thomas's pleas of like, okay, again, it's my birthday. Please don't tell anyone that I'm here. And Smith's like, no, I'm not going to promise that. You see, I think it's just a little bit of the like, I'm not going to specifically throw you under the bus, but I'm also not going to like protect you either.
If anybody asks.
So Thomas ends up really anxious. So he actually goes and seeks protection from the very same detective who tracked him down, asking the bemused man to stay with him for the night. Early the next morning, he raced back to the idyllic little prairie town he had been living in, where once again he had a wife wondering where her husband had gone off to. He wasted no time in formulating a plan to flee the United States entirely. Only this time, his wife would be coming with him.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, he's showing growth.
He's growing, yeah. That's good. That's what we like to see.
Yeah, or he's just... It's just such a fuck you to the first wife. It's like, no. Like, it's not that I would never take a wife with me.
It
I
is
wouldn't
specifically
take you.
You. It is yeah, you. You are the problem.
Yeah. Sorry, Mary. Have you tried being 20? Because that's my thing. Thomas had to explain, at least in part, why they needed to run off so urgently. But one way or another, he managed to convince her. So same deal here. We can't really know for sure, like, whether he was keeping her in the dark or whether she really knew stuff. It's likely she didn't know everything. It's likely, I think, that she probably knew a little. Like, she knew he was being pursued. That had to be part of his, like, pitch. Like, we have to go.
Mm-hmm.
So together, they doubled back along the same route, ending up again in New York. New York, baby!
New York!
The Big Apple!
New York.
Love the Islanders.
Love the Mets. Love the formerly New York Dragons of the Arena Football League.
Hate Staten Island. Don't love Staten Island.
Nope.
So they ended up in New York. And from there, they board the next ship in our narrative, the Herman. On January 13th, 1866, they began to steam their way across the Atlantic. Their end goal was to reach Dresden, and according to Ann Larrabee's figures, their actual savings they'd managed to pack were in excess of $45,000. So that's after giving up 10. If we're comfortable assuming they had at least another 73 cents kicking around, in today's terms, they would have been sitting on more than $888,888.88.
Let's go with that.
Yeah, it's just a fun little like near round number I found. So, Well, not a round number, but an eight number.
It's a really, eight is a very round number.
Yeah. So they've got $45,000. And on top of this, Larrabee speculates that Thomas also had money invested in Wall Street, but there's, again, no real way to verify. Throughout his wheelings and dealings, Thomas used a variety of partially or even entirely fake names, and he changed it again at this stage to assist in his anonymity within their new environment. We'll go over his various pseudonyms later on, but for clarity and consistency, we'll continue to identify him as William King Thomas. His baseline knowledge of German, so again, baseline knowledge of German or possibly Swiss German, with an accrued interest in the finer points of culture, allowed them to adopt what the author calls, quote, plausible disguises as a wealthy Southern gentleman married to a genteel, educated lady from New Orleans. Neither of which is true. Dresden, for its part, was a highly cosmopolitan city that was already home to hundreds of new money Americans. There was even an American club, which Thomas quickly ingratiated himself into, to the point of its members electing him as its vice president. He even made friends with retired Union Navy men, including ones who had hunted the very blockade runners that Thomas had funded. Possibly his most famous acquaintance was Commodore John Worden, who had commanded the USS Monitor against the CSS Virginia at the Battle of Hampton Roads, the first ever battle between ironclads. Did you cover that? I tried searching your feed. I don't think you have.
We have not covered that specific battle. We talked about the Monitor. It's come up a few times just because it's such a, you know, sort of a pioneering technology. But no, we've never specifically covered Hampton Roads.
Far from downplaying his Confederate dealings among such company, Thomas leaned into it. One lie he regularly told his peers here was that he'd been born in North Carolina, wounded in the Confederate military, and made his fortune running blockades himself and making shrewd investments. So again, any stuff that comes from him, he is like an inveterate liar through and through.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to this, when the Thomases had made landfall, they did so in a port called Bremerhaven, which was an exclave of the city-state of Bremen. Dresden, meanwhile, stood as the capital of the Kingdom of Saxony. Both Bremen and Saxony were sovereign entities within the larger German Confederation, a sort of supranational alliance that had a legislative body but no head of state itself. If you think all that sounds a bit convoluted and inefficient, you're not alone. So did one former member of that legislature, now the Minister President of Prussia, a man named Otto von Bismarck.
I was saying, I recently read a very good biography of Bismarck by Jonathan Steinberg, I think is the author's name.
Mm.
Obviously, it's a big book. It's very dense, but it was pretty readable. I learned a lot of stuff about Germany at that time that I did not know. Also, I was going to say Bremerhaven. Shout out to Bremerhaven. That comes up quite a bit on our show, actually, just because it's a big naval center, obviously.
Yeah, okay. I got the sense that like it is kind of like it's very strategically positioned for...
Yeah, a lot of like shipbuilding and then like any of our stories that have involved like German ships, a lot of times are coming out of Bremerhaven.
Yeah, I think I was actually listening to one of yours recently and I was like, Bremerhaven mentioned. Yeah. A few months after the Thomases reached Dresden, so did the Prussians, and William King Thomas was absolutely beside himself that he got to be near another war. In the book, we get a few glimpses of an account from his own wife.
Wait, is this 1860? What year is this? 1866?
This is, I believe it's the 7 weeks war they're talking about initially.
Okay, yeah, that'd be, yeah, 1866.
Yeah, okay, that's right, yeah, because it's not the Franco-Prussian War, it's the 7 weeks war, yeah.
Day by day, he pored over the newspaper, closely following the battles, many of which were taking place within 150 miles to the southeast. According to Cecilia, he became so single-mindedly absorbed in war coverage that he would lose control of himself and rave about scenes of bloodshed described in it as though he were mad. His imaginary projection of himself into the 7 weeks' war was so complete that immediately after it was over, he insisted that Cecilia go with him on a tour of the battlefields, although she was weak and grieving from a miscarriage. Stopping little to eat or drink, they traveled across the mountains through Bohemia's ravaged fields and villages, tracing the paths of the armies. William seemed to gloat over the awful sights and to be oblivious to anything but them. When the Thomases returned to Dresden, Cecilia's doctor told William he was crazy for subjecting his wife to such a trip in her post-miscarriage state.
So, yeah, again, his, I don't know if he's being nicer to this wife. I guess less shitty somehow, but he finds new ways to be shitty.
Like, he is bringing her with him on things, but, like, at the worst possible time that he could make her go on this trip.
Yeah. And you notice it says she was grieving. Like, obviously, she's weak from the miscarriage. She's right. Grieving. He's not grieving, I guess.
He's having a great time. He's out. He's getting to see his battlefields.
Yeah. Over the next few years, Thomas had a number of trips back across the ocean, visiting New York. New York!
New York!
For unclear reasons. New York!
Baby!
On several of these voyages, he regaled acquaintances old and new with fantastic old war stories and unsubstantiated claims of current smuggling endeavors. One of the pieces of extremely unconfirmed lore that later emerged is that in January 1870, coinciding with one of these trips in which Thomas wired home nearly 1,000 British pounds, there was a rather mysterious shipwreck. The SS City of Boston, which left New York en route to Liverpool with a stopover in Halifax, disappeared off the coast of Nova Scotia along with about 200 unfortunate souls. A number of possible stories surfaced. A violent storm hit the area 2 days after her departure. Collision with an iceberg was even speculated. Contemporary reporting told of a handful of recovered messages. For example, on April 26 of 1870.
Shipping intelligence, a relic of the city of Boston. Truro, Monday morning, a thin slip of wood, 3 feet long, painted blue, was picked up at Perranporth? Is
that... Sure.
Oh, it's a Cornish name. Okay, so no one's going to know. Painted blue was picked up at Perranporth on the north coast of Cornwall yesterday, and in large letters cut in the wood was written, City of Boston is sinking, February 11th. Another sentence commencing with the letter M appears to have begun, but the board is unfortunately broken off.
Yeah, the reading with the City of Boston was interesting. Like, this is definitely something you do a whole episode on because it's quite mysterious.
Yeah, it's one I've never even heard of.
On terms of, there's a lot of shipwrecks.
Yeah, well, yeah, there are. Well, I mean, if you look at it, it's like there's an estimated like something like 6,000 ships have sunk in just in the Great Lakes. So oh it's like, God. So yeah, like my concern when we started the podcast was like, oh, we're gonna run out of shipwrecks, and like we are not. Like, we're never going to.
Yeah. On May 10th, the Leeds Mercury reported on another two alleged letters. The first allegedly came from a stone bottle found in Waterloo, from context, because there's a million Waterloos throughout like the British colonial world. Mm-hmm. I think this is just the area near Liverpool.
Did something big happen there that makes them use this name?
I don't know. I don't know anything about history. Mm-hmm. So this was dated February 4th, reading, quote, "The city of Boston is fast settling. We have lost 4 men overboard. 3 have died. In great danger for our preservation. The ship is on fire and hurrying all the passengers to the bows. We have had to come on under canvas. Our propeller is broken, and we are now at the entire mercy of the waves. God help us. I ham hon my bare feet and have been all the week." I believe that was like exactly how it was written.
I ham hon.
Yeah. I ham. Oh, yeah. If we finally got some cat action. You want to come up, buddy? God help us, I ham hon my bare feet and have been all the week. So there's just switching their aces around. H's. You gotta, they never mug for the camera. Usually they like to come set up when I'm, or they come hang out here when I'm setting up. Well, there you go, buddy.
One of ours, Winston, will like, if you pull the camera out, he will like sit and pose for you. And then Palouche like knows what you're doing and he'll like turn his face away. He's very camera shy.
Like, I feel like they know what they're doing. Like, they, because, like, often when I'm setting up, they want to, like, get their noses in here.
It's like they know they're fucking something up, and, like, that's really all that matters.
And then when I'm like, all right, this will be great for, like, you know, the gram or whatever, if you actually walk around when I'm recording, and then it's like, eh, are you come sit on my mouse pad again? Yeah, this is where he hangs out. Just below the actual... Just below the actual camera range. I thought about setting up just like a cat cam just to point this way. But I was like, yeah, we got no time for this. Thank you. The paper added, quote, "We are informed that the names signed do not appear in the articles of agreement with the crew." Okay, thank you for scrolling away from my quote. The paper added, quote, "We are informed that the names signed do not appear in the articles of agreement with the crew. If, therefore, the paper is not a hoax, it must be signed by the passengers." The second was supposedly from a bottle found on one of the beaches of Staten Island. And I checked, there's only the one Staten Island. Mm-hmm. New York, baby.
New York, baby. Staten Island, the Wu-Tang Clan.
Yes, that's right. Was only described. The second was. Yeah, if you want to come up, come up. Anyway, the second was only described by the paper.
It bore date March 2nd. And stated that the ship had taken fire that morning in the engine room and was fast driving passengers to the bow of the ship, and that in attempting to launch the lifeboat, it was swamped, and 40 people, male and female, perished.
That's not a toy.
That actually worked well. That sounded kind of like an ominous, like, bell, which is perfect after the 40 people perished.
It did, yeah. This letter was signed by a name that the paper seemingly was able to confirm was that of a passenger. I couldn't find an explanation for the discrepancy and whether they had the passenger list or not. And later, in November of the same year, basically this one, the way they have it punctuated is confusing to me, so I decided to make it your problem.
The city of Boston. A bottle has been cast upon the shores of the West, which presumes to throw some light upon the mystery enveloping the loss of the missing steamer City of Boston. Obviously, however, the relic must be received with reserve, especially as we are without any collateral evidence of its authenticity. On Saturday, a bottle appears to have come in and been picked up on Cranstock Sands, 2 miles west of New Quay. On being opened, it was found to contain 4 or 5 pieces of envelope, upon which the following names and words are written in pencil. O. Jones, E. Williams, Seth, A Collision, 403 Greenwich Street, New York, New York, Evan Evans, Cadenced? Landwheel. We are lost. City of Boston. We are all sinking. Goodbye. I should like my... Written in ink. Michael Jones. Caribou House. 212 Fulton Street, New York. There is some other writing in pencil, which our correspondent thinks is Welsh. Upon the envelopes, there are 2 postmarks also. One is as follows. Ebenezer A. JY470. The other ringed mark reads, London, AC, JY, January, maybe?
I think so.
570. The derelict bottle bears evidence of having been many months in the water.
So yeah, the reporting is just all over the place where it's like, it's interesting how they're writing, like, here's my home address, like my exact home address.
Also, like, one thing that I was kind of surprised by when we started doing these is that, like, around this time, like, late 1800s, how surprisingly common it was for people to make fake messages in bottles.
That's kind of what I was thinking at a certain point, because a lot of these are so contradictory with their dates that everyone's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if I just, like, if people could think they found the city of Boston, or like,
or it'll be like sometimes you'll see it where, like, there was like a passenger list, you know, published in the newspaper, like presumed lost, and then like a few weeks later a bottle will wash up with the message. And it'll be signed with a name, and it's like, oh, but like, that was this guy's legal name, but that's not the name he signed on papers. Why would he sign this letter with his name he didn't use? So it's like a lot of those. It was like a surprisingly popular pastime. You didn't have a lot else to do in the 1870s.
Yeah, exactly.
Just make messages in bottles.
Yeah, again, it's just that much harder. Like, it's another example of how hard it was to fact check. Because it's like, well, is this writing Welsh? There's no way to find out.
There's no possible way we could find this out.
I can't read it, but it doesn't look French. It's probably Welsh.
It's English letters, but it's like unpronounceable to me, so it's probably Welsh. A lot of L's in here, I'm seeing. A lot of W's. Weird.
A lot of L's and a lot of W's. What are they, a middling team? Anyway. you're posing so good, dude. All right. Another paper, the Glasgow Herald, alluded in March to unconfirmed reporting that the city of Boston had been, according to contemporary insurance regulations, overladen by 18 to 20 inches when she left the United States.
Oof.
Is that, like, high for being overladen? I don't know. You've probably seen more of these than I have.
I mean, it sounds like quite a bit. I'm sure the acceptable depth probably changes based on the size of the ship, But like, yeah, I mean, I would say almost, that's what, getting close to almost 2 feet. So yeah, I mean, that sounds bad to me. I don't know.
In the end, though, all that was left was fragmented, dubious evidence and speculation. The mystery was never solved, although later a conspiracy theory would tie its sinking to none other than William King Thomas. Just how this connection was made will come up a bit later. One thing that was uncovered by later investigation was that Thomas was engaged in relatively minor smuggling at the time, essentially running an illegal transatlantic duty-free operation. A game like this could probably have supported a lot of people's lifestyles, but not the Thomases. In their social circle, they wanted to appear rich, so they lived rich. As retold in The Fiend.
They burned through the money at a fantastic rate on entertainment, fashion, and travel. Cecilia adored shopping. She was happily welcomed at all the best shops, and she would later be harshly blamed for her extravagant spending on fine linens, silks, sealskins, furs, and diamond jewelry. In hindsight, the gossips thought her desire to be a grand lady and mother of adorably dressed children finally sent her husband, unable to keep up with her appetite, over the edge into madness.
Yeah, again, an interesting thing of what people over the edge. It's always fashion, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I swear to God, if you buy one more sealskin. Sealskins? What is she doing? Is she surfing on, like, a crab boat? What is...
Yeah, like, there's... like, I don't think they were... Their conspicuous consumption was necessarily, like... It was not necessarily like coherent,
like useful stuff. It's like,
yeah, it's just like, hey, it's 87. Do you know you could buy a seal skin? Wow, what do we do that? I don't know, but we can buy it. All right, let's buy it. We have a few of the numbers available to us, the gist of which I can only describe as drill candle tweet lifestyle. If that makes any sense to you,
please. My family is dying.
And this toy should be more interesting than the microphone. You know, I'll just put it in your neck. In late 1871, his $45,000. This is 5 years later. His $45,000 had shrunk to only $5,000, and a year later, it was only half that. All the same, they were still trying to hire domestic help. William traveled in first class and stayed in luxury hotels, and Cecilia held a debt of $1,429 to one milliner alone. Do you know what a milliner is?
Someone who makes ladies' hats.
Yeah. So for context, that is just over $28,000 in 2024 US dollars just on hats at one store.
Can anyone who's good at finances help me?
Yeah.
A milliner is specifically ladies' hats, I think, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
I think
yeah.
A haberdasher is the other one who makes, I don't know if he only makes men's hats, but I think that's the other hat maker.
I think you're right. So it's just like $28,000 in one store on her hats.
For modern listeners, imagine going to Lids and spending $28,000.
Yeah. Or to a candle store.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, this reminded me of another thing from our Confederate blockade episode. By the end of the war, when everyone in the Confederacy is obviously like just ruinously, like rich people have lost most of their money. People can't eat. People with the money to do so are still purchasing new slaves super, super late in the war, even though they have nothing to do with them. They don't need another slave. Literally as kind of like this, an outward show of, well, we are still the Confederate slave owning aristocracy. We are still the same people. Like, the Union is not going to beat us. So yeah, I will take another slave, I think. Just insane.
Yeah. At the end of 1873, William King Thomas had a paltry $1,600 to his name, which was just in time for the economic crisis known as the Panic of 1873. It's not known exactly whether he had much invested in any European or North American stock markets, but if he did, there's a very good chance he would have lost it all. According to secondhand reports, in the time following the panic, his mental state degraded. He cursed his old friends. He abused his wife. He began to consort with clockmakers.
Is that slang, or is that who's actually hanging out with?
Well, we'll find out in part three.
Ah.
But for now, do you have anything you want to plug?
I guess I will plug my own podcast again. The podcast that I do with my brother Taylor, Beyond the Breakers, Shipwrecks, Lost, Lessons Learned from Maritime Disasters. Check us out on Patreon. We do some fun stuff over there. There's a $3 tier for able sea people, and there's a $5 tier for second mates. You get an extra episode each month at the $3 tier. You get two extra episodes each month at the $5 tier. Check it out.
And I would like to plug petting a cute cat who's sitting on your mouse pad. And while you're doing that, you need something to listen to, you can head over to the link tree for Born Under Punches found in our description. And you'll find all the audio and video versions, links to our Discord. You can jump in there and you can see pictures of these cats and the puppy that you may have seen on camera or heard about. And yeah. And if you don't join the Discord, that's fine. Je m'en calise.
Born Under Punches is a collaborative effort between me, Kelly Gomo, and a variety of contributors to create a variety of shows. If you want to support the project, you can do so by following us and our friends on our various socials. Check out the episode description for all the relevant links, especially this one. Patreon.com/BornUnderPunches. No E in punches. By supporting us on Patreon, you can enable this show to sustain itself and produce regular episodes. Join at the basic tier for expanded access to our Discord server, donate at an elevated level for monthly bonus content, or even fund us at the highest amount. And once a month, I will draw anything you ask me to on an index card. And hey, if money's an object, word of mouth goes a long, long way.
Blue, blue, what a pup! Oh, how she loves the Stanley Cup! Hockey man is what I am! Let's go! Listen, listen to what I say. Play that game the Canadian way. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go!
Any sources used in the episode you just heard can also be found in the description. This content was primarily produced in Amiskwetsiwaskaykan, the traditional territory of the Nahiwak, Nakota, Nitsitapi, Mikawe, Métis, and other nations. Also known as Edmonton, Alberta, in Western Treaty 6 territory. Thanks for listening, and happy trails to you.